Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. This show is available on iTunes, and like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Well, friends, we got through another week, a busy week. Of course, it's the holiday season, so it's going to be very busy until the first week of January. So just you and me this week. We'll probably do a show next week. I'm not 100%. And I think because of the Christmas week. And then, of course, the following is New Year's weekend, and I'm probably not going to do a show on New Year's weekend. But, and of course, I like to be the last critic on Earth to reveal their top 10 list. So you might expect that the first Friday in January. But we got some material I want to talk about. We will grab a pencil. And I need to apologize. I forgot in my recordings last week to raise a glass to Kirstie Alley. So I'd forgotten how much of a decent movie run she had in the 1980s. Of course, best known for her work on Cheers and in Veronica's Closet and Fat Actress on television. But started out in, Star Trek II and Champions, Blind Date, Runaway. I know it's a TV movie, but A Bunny's Tale, of course, I'm going to bring that up. And in the underappreciated Summer School, which I love to this date, and, you know, she has one of the great gestures in 80s comedy for me in that picture. Kept doing films like Shoot to Kill, Loverboy, she got a lot of money doing Look Who's Talking films, good for her. And then films like Madhouse, Sibling Rivalry, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, A Village of the Damned, 1995, with Christopher Reeve and John Carpenter. Deconstructing Harry, Drop Dead Gorgeous, cult hit. She's got a cult following even with the political leanings and the Scientology aspect of her career, of her life. So, yeah, salute to Kirstie Alley. I forgot to mention that last week, so I'm sorry. And we will have a little audio treatment, tribute to Angelo Badamanti. I hope I'm saying that right. Sorry, Brian. I'll probably play the theme from Blue Velvet, but man, going back and thinking about the stuff he did without David Lynch, Tough Guys Don't Dance, Weeds, Cousins. He did Nightmare on Elm Street 3. He did National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, The Comfort of Strangers, which is now out on Criterion. Yes, we mentioned Wild at Heart and Twin Peaks and Blue Velvet. Naked in New York, City of Lost Children, Lost Highway, of course, it was with Lynch, Arlington Road, Straight Story, my favorite film from 1999, Holy Smoke, Forever Mine, The Beach, Mulholland Drive, Secretary, yes, I'm scrolling, Autofocus, another Autofocus reference in the last span, a couple of months, Cabin Fever, Resistance, Push, Dominion, underappreciated prequel to The Exorcist, the remake of The Wicker Man, we won't talk about that, A Woman, A Butterfly Kiss, A Late Quartet, The Wait. So a lot of work there from Angela, we'll play a little bit at the end of the program. And then quickly around the horn, this weekend, Friday and Saturday, 2 and 7:30 p.m., and then Sunday, 2 and 5:30 p.m., National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. It's not movies, but Thursday, December 22nd at 6:30 p.m., the Jerry Navarro Trio will be doing music from A Charlie Brown Christmas at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin. Okay, opening at the Can-Can on the 20th of December, the morning, that's the day I'm going to be sleeping in because December 19th is my birthday. Finally, coming to town after its kind of preview at the Heartland Film Festival is Darren Aronofsky's The Whale. And one of the things I've been noticing going through the Christmas films, the kind of award screeners, the award contenders. And by the way, the IFJA is meeting this week. We will announce our winners on Monday. And then obviously on the next show, I will make that announcement. But what I've noticed a lot are noted directors whose films are kind of a step down from their previous work. I mentioned this with Noah Baumbach, which probably is the biggest example of that, and David O. Russell. And this one is kind of a step down. That's not saying it's bad. I'm just saying it's not at the same level for a film like Black Swan and The Wrestler. And by the way, there's a lot of The Whale that is very similar to both of those films. Of course, this is based on a play. Can't wait to see. I'd love to see a stage version of this. It's Brendan Fraser as Charlie, as a morbidly obese gay divorced man who is stuck in his home trying to reconnect with his daughter, played by Sadie Sink. His best friend is his healthcare companion, played by Liz, played by Hong Chow. There is a young man who comes to the door, a church missionary. I will say the opening scene right out of the gate, one of the more uncomfortable moments in Darren Aronofsky's filmography, and that's saying a lot. Mentioning the two films I did with The Wrestler and Black Swan, of a lead that pushes their body to the extreme. And in the case of Charlie, yeah, the eating and the drinking and, you know, how much of a challenge it is for him to move. But it's a different aspect of that. It's really uncomfortable at times to watch Charlie go down on a downward spiral. It's a lovely performance by Brendan Fraser. You go for the Brendan Fraser performance and the Hong Chow performance. And coming off the bench in another film, she was really good. And she said she's even better in this. Samantha Morton plays the ex-wife who shows up and just blasts Charlie. But it is a lovely performance from Fraser because it's emotional, not just the physical. When this film comes out on video, on DVD and Blu-ray, yeah, physical copies, 2022, whatever. I can't wait to see the look, how they made the prosthetics, what camera CG they used to make him look this large. And he also appears taller. I think he is already a tall guy, but no, it is a heartbreaking performance from Brendan Fraser, and. You know, yes, this is the Brendan Fraser Renaissance. We've been talking about this for about a year. The film world. Of course, he's every film festival he has attended, he has been hit with great fanfare. He's gone through a lot. He is a part of the Me Too movement. Not a bad story about the guy. So I remember getting out of the screening of this, and the film rep asked me about, is he a lock for Best Actor at the Academy Awards? Probably. It's a really strong chance. Now, the voting committee, the voting members are different now. They're more diverse. They're younger. We'll see about this. I know some folks are going to talk about the fact that he's a straight man and a not thin man playing the role, but I'm fine with this. Of course, it's easy for old straight white guy to say that. But it is a lovely performance, but this is the story you read. It's like watching a championship game, where all I want is a really good story, a good game, and a story to go with it. And I think this year the story to write, along with some of the cast of Everything Everywhere All at Once. But this is the story to write about the rise of Brendan Fraser. So go for that performance, if anything else. Yeah, because it's set mostly in one location, So there is that aspect of it. I don't mind the claustrophobic aspect of it. I don't mind when you film a play and you just keep it in one location. The relationship between father and daughter has already been covered for me by Aronofsky and The Wrestler, and I think it's much stronger in that aspect. Ellie is much more plotting and conniving compared to the other daughter. And the ending of this is very much like The Wrestler and Black Swan. So it is not as big a it doesn't have as big a punch for me on that. So, yeah, it is not as good as Black Swan or The Wrestler, but you go for the performances. So that's The Whale opening December 20th at Can-Can. So there you go. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. You know, I'm going to call an audible. Before we grab a pencil, there's one other aspect I want to talk about with The Whale. And then we're going to dip into the archives. And I'll explain why after we have grabbed a pencil. Okay. I'm hoping that the young people who go to see it, hopefully if they go see The Whale, and I know that's old guy. Oh, this is the show for the young people, Film Sociology. But I'm hoping if young people go see The Whale, whether it's out of curiosity or whether they hear there's a lot of Oscar buzz, that there isn't an ew factor when it comes to seeing the Brendan Fraser character, when it comes to seeing him in his warts and all. That there is, hopefully, by the end of the film, there is obviously sympathy with Charlie. And anybody who has ever had an addiction will be able to relate to this, whether it, you know, trying your best to stay clean and when you have a fall and how much it hurts. It's uncomfortable to watch somebody in doing when they hop off their wagon and dive right in. And that happens in this film as well. So anyway, that's just my extra 2 cents on The Whale. So before we grab a pencil, I had something happen this week. As I mentioned, the IFJA is meeting on this weekend at an undisclosed location to discuss the awards for the IFJA. And as I was, you know, kind of wrapping things up and getting my ballot ready, I finally visited the latest David Cronenberg film, Crimes of the Future. This is the one with Viggo Mortensen, Lisa Due, and Kristen Stewart. A note to all three of you, to Neon, who released the film, to David Cronenberg, and to the film itself. I just got a case of the giggles when looking at the disc that was sent to me, and they opened the description on the back of the box, on the back of the folder, which the disc was on, with the words, "In the not-too-distant future." I'm sorry, you can't use that anymore. Well, you can, but I'm going to be thinking of Mystery Science Theater. So, and I know this is a serious film, and it's an odd one. It's, you know, Cronenberg likes to do these. If you like Existence, you'll like, or Crash to a certain, even more Existence. But if you like David Cronenberg's Existence, you'll like Crimes of the Future when it comes to self-mutilation as performance art, and it's this synthetic environment and avant-garde performances, and it's very Cronenberg-y. So there you go. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. My buddies over at Golden Globus, this week they are doing Fist of the North Star. For you fans of Gary Daniels, there might be. They had a fun tippy-tap, a part one of a tippy-tap of the Magnum P.I. Murder, She Wrote crossover. Part two is happening up, I think, Sunday. And next week, they're going to be discussing Caligula. And I remember when that came out on video, and that was one of the go-to movies, naughty movies, that young teenage boys wanted to go watch. And, man, it is boring AF. And, you know, the story behind it is Bob Guccione, the publisher of Penthouse, wanted to make this film, and Gore Vidal did the screenplay. And you had legit actors like Malcolm McDowell, Peter O'Toole, Helen Mirren, John Gielgud. This is the early 80s. And they tried to make this kind of Roman orgy film. Well, they were making, the actors thought they were in a standard period piece. They were not there, and Malcolm McDowell tells a famous story where he's delivering one of his monologues, and it cuts back to a couple having sex, which was obviously filmed on another day in another location. So they did not sign up for a skin flick, a very expensive skin flick, a long, expensive skin flick. So Golden Globus guys, man, hang in there, boy, because it was... It was not the. I remember as a teenage boy, was very excited to watch it, and man, for a lot of skin, really dull. So anyway, that's from Golden Globus Theater. All right, friends, grab a pencil. Let's find out what you've been watching this week. We start on Twitter with Hugh, who writes, "I watched White Noise last week and can't decide whether I liked it. Maybe I should just." Have reread the book and rewatch A Marriage Story instead. That's probably good advice, Hugh. Yeah, because I was disappointed by the film. And Josie Alma Press writes, "Freeway, the uncut version. I believe that is getting that got a Blu-ray release. Cool." Eric writes, "You just reminded me to watch North by Northwest again. One of my all-time favorites." Yeah, I used the Cary Grant running away from the airplane GIF. For this week's podcast, or for this week's reminder of what you've been watching this week. So we switch over to Facebook. Jamie writes, "Snow Globe, Holiday in Handcuffs, The Santa Claus, Home Alone 2, Rudolph's Shiny New Year, Santa Claus 2 and 3, Live Action, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, and The Little Drummer Boy." Andrea writes, "The Luckiest Girl Alive. Wow." Andra Faye writes, "George and Tammy and some corny Christmas movies plus Zero Dark Thirty." All right, Andra Faye, wait a minute. You got to tell us what corny Christmas movies you were watching. I knew you just sandwiched that inside a Jessica Chastain double feature, which is pretty good. It's funny. Speaking of which, I just finally finished Scenes from a Marriage. So going through award screeners, I needed to cleanse my palate every now and then. And, yeah, I used the HBO version of Scenes from a Marriage. I liked it. I liked the performances. Still doesn't hold a candle to Ingmar Bergman's masterpiece. But, no, Andra Faye, next time you got to tell us what corny movies you've been watching. You're in a safe environment unless I say something. But, it's all good. Doug writes, "Is this black enough for you?" I need to finish that, Doug. Thank you for reminding me. Max Steiner, maestro of movie music, Whistle Down the Road, and The Bishop's Wife. David writes, "The Banshees of Inisherin, Amsterdam, and Rambo." John writes, "This wins..." Oh, the gif of North by Northwest. "This wins an award for best use of a green screen on an Indiana cornfield." Thank you, John. Judy writes, "Spirited." Roxana writes, "Into the Woods," and although not a film, White Lotus. Yes, a lot of people are talking about White Lotus. It's okay. John writes, "In the Theater, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, the live-action version, and Elf. At Home, Port of New York, and Glory. And unfortunately, I watched Gone Girl for the second time because my wife had never seen it. It's that not unconditional love and sacrifice on my part. I don't know what is." John, it's funny you mentioned that. I have Gone Girl on Blu-ray, and I haven't gotten to it to revisit it yet. But yeah, talk about a couple who were made for each other. Amanda writes, Amanda's been to the library. "Remember the Night, The Intruder, Christmas Eve, and a lot of holiday specials on the TV." Thank you, Amanda. That's fine. But Andra Faye, you got to tell us what corny movies you're watching. Craig, oh man, here we go. Craig's zigging a lot of people thought he'd be zagging, or what, the other way around. "The Curse of Frankenstein, The Horror of Dracula, Children of the Damned, Dracula, Prince of Darkness. Barbara Shelley is so good in this. It's my favorite of the Hammer Draculas." Almost forgot. Oh, Taffy, this is for you. Dracula AD, 1973. Wait a minute. That's 1972, Craig, not 1973. Now I want a Dracula AD, 1973. Even more wah-wah, even more 70s garb. So, yeah, Dracula AD, 1972. And there's a correction happening here on Film Sociology. All right. Brian writes, Spirited 2022 on Apple TV. Yeah, my wife really digs that film. And I watched it, and yeah, it's cute. I liked it a little more than I thought. Okay, I see what you did there, Abdul. Abdul Kim Shabazz writes, The Candidate. Okay, I swear I'm going to stop typing while I'm on the show. All right. Eric writes, first view, Jordan Peele's Nope, the rewatch, our quasi-annual holiday screening of White Christmas. Thank you, Eric. Paul writes, I endured the new All Quiet on the Western Front. And he says, the moral of the story, war is bad. Thank you, Paul. Abby writes, Home Alone 1 and 2. Daniel writes, Cactus Flower, Breaking the Code, The Boatniks, Falling, The Man... Not the play I was in. The Man Who Came to Dinner, Bros, Moon Over Miami, and 6 Minutes to Midnight. Not 2 Minutes to Midnight, that's Iron Maiden. Taylor writes, Casablanca, Pillow Talk, and Girlfriends. I need to watch Girlfriends. I know that's out on Criterion, Taylor. Thank you for that reminder. Lucy writes, 2001. Robert Muggy writes, Pinocchio, Guillermo del Toro's Senior. Ride the High Country. I love Ride the High Country. The Far Country, and Inside Schofield. Christian writes, the Jim Carrey version of The Grinch, which I had never seen because I loved the cartoon so much and didn't want to ruin that. It was okay. And my all-time favorite, It's a Wonderful Life. Thank you, Christian. Yes, Christian and I worked on It's a Wonderful Life many, many moons ago. So I wound up having more of a love for It's a Wonderful Life because of my directing at Anderson University and the one show at the firehouse. John writes two sappy Christmas movies, comma, oldies. John, gotta tell us what they are. Can't do that. Like Melissa here, Santa Claus the Movie, Merry Kiss Cam, I Believe in Santa, Haul Out the Holly, and two other Hallmark Christmas movies, Names Escape Me. That's a legitimate understanding, Melissa, because the titles, like the movies, all kind of bleed together after a while. But you gave us actual titles, Melissa. Thank you. Melissa's also one. I called her out. I literally took out my phone and called her while I was scrolling when she was vague on the grab a pencil portion of Film Sociology, which is what you're listening to. Gretchen writes Scrooged. David writes Nomadland, Motherless Brooklyn, 3,000 Years of Longing, A Few Good Men, Miracle on 34th Street, 1947 and 1994, and Muppet Christmas Carol. Happy 30th anniversary to A Muppet Christmas Carol. For a lot of people, their only Christmas Carol, the only one that matters for a lot of folks, and that's really high up there on mine as well. Great Michael Caine performance, and it's fun. There was a fun photo of Caine that was floating around. It always floats around December time, but it's the studio. We want to do a really fun, lighthearted Christmas movie with the Muppets, and of course Michael Caine's treating it like it is a Shakespearean tragedy, or in this case a Dickensian tragedy. So very good. Rachel writes, Big Mama, like Big Mama's House, like Father, like Son, A Christmas Carol Goes Wrong, and Peter Pan Goes Wrong. Oh yeah, those. Tony writes Minari and Loving Vincent. Nick Rogers writes Close, Subject, Last Seen Alive, that bat film. All Ladies Do It. I'm not saying that. All Ladies Do It, Arabella, Black Angel, Scream for Help, Champagne and Bullets, A Christmas Story, Christmas, the sequel, Violent Night, The Ref, Poker Face, Blackout, and Elf. Sean writes Hawking. Michelle writes Merry Friggin' Christmas, First Three Diehards, The Postman, and then wrote Tried Watching the Quiet Earth, didn't get very far. Understood. And finally, Andrew writes White Christmas, Notting Hill, The Imitation Game, Runaway Bride, and Burnt. And there you are, friends. That's what you've been watching this week. So hopefully you got to watch some fun films that are good films that are new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Fooled you, didn't I? All right. Show's all over the place. This week, it is the birthday of my dear friend and kind of alumni emeritus of film sociology, Mike Perry. Now, back when Mike used to work with WFYI, I love to tell this story, he was our Tony Randall. And what I mean by that is when, now in the old days of when David Letterman was on NBC, if he had a guest that dropped out, he could call either Terry Garr or Tony Randall, because apparently they lived like around the block from NBC. He would call them and they would come on and just talk and just have a fun interview. So because back then you didn't have to be promoting something that just happened. So, and Mike was, I love Mike, and he was great about either being either a regular guest or B, my Tony Randall. And, you know, there were times where I would note when I would ask him if he could come on. I think the closest that I ever asked Mike to be on was 5 minutes before we went to air. This was back when Film Sociology was live. So, So I always had to let him know. And then when I asked him to be a regular guest, I would inform him that he's being a regular guest. Well, it's Mike's birthday this week, and since I don't know if I'm doing a show next week, this is a great excuse to pull out of the archives a film sociology classic. It's my conversation with Mike and Chris Elberfeld talking about one of our favorite slob comedies of the early 1980s, The Hollywood Nights. Enjoy.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever. Yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Welcome, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or comment, you can email me at msosi@WFYI.org. Also on Facebook, also on Twitter at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes. And we have a blog, which is at WFYI.tumblr.com. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't get to say this much often, very often with this program, but you are about to encounter a very special film sociology, one for the children and one for the family. So, and I have two guys I've been wanting to get as a trio for a while, but I'm going to start with, sir, if you could verbally sign in and your position here at WFYI.
Yes, thank you, Matt. My name is Chris Elberfeld, and I actually work in the television production department as a director of photography. But Matt and I, when we first met, I think one of the first conversations we had was a
this subject.
Quote for quote, yes.
Of this film.
So of this film, yes.
Now, our other guest, well, if you're a longtime listener, you know him. You know him so well, he has his own intro.
Lawrence of Arabia. He's an English guy. He came to fight the Turkish.
Okay, Clark, right there. That's what I'm talking about. Lawrence of Arabia. Doesn't have any lyrics to it. Doesn't have any words.
What do you mean doesn't have lyrics?
It's music.
To it?
It's music.
Hey, I've seen the movie four times.
And there were no words to it.
What are you
There are no words to that. Did you hear what I was saying earlier?
Somewhere I know that somebody, I think, wrote lyrics to this song.
And Mike Perry's in the house.
Well, someone had to write lyrics to that song. How else would he be singing it?
Exactly, exactly. So, Mike, Chris, thanks for hanging out. So, ladies and gentlemen, what brings this trio together besides odd taste in films and camaraderie? From 1980, a film called The Hollywood Nights. And that's what we're talking about today because, quite honestly, I didn't get a chance to see the big blockbusters opening this weekend. And, frankly, I don't want to. So I want to talk about this. We were able to finagle all of our schedules together as one. These are three separate zip codes happening at the same time, folks. So your pledge dollars at work. And what a better way to spend your pledge dollars than talking about this film.
WFYI.org/give.
Exactly. So, Chris, I know Chris and I and Mike and I talked about this film early on when we first got to know each other. And this is now we are men of a certain age, not the HBO series, but we are of a certain age. This is probably one of the top quoted films of our canon.
Or at least of our department.
Right. Yes. Yeah. We don't have a list, but there are certain ones you could quote along quite often.
Yes.
So
this is another timeless classic from that. From that decade, from that niche.
Yeah,
it's the era that gave us Porky's and name another one.
Caddyshack.
Yeah. Last Times at Ridgemont High.
There have been, and it's funny because as I was setting this up, I had a dear friend on social media, hi Moneypenny, who was dying to find out what we were talking about, and she gave a couple good guesses, but we'll get to those in a little bit. But this was at the height of the R-rated slob comedy. Which I think starts in the mid-70s, but we'll get to that in a little bit. For me, The Hollywood Nights is the most underrated of the group. People know Porky's, people know Animal House, people know Caddyshack, but this was one, it was a smaller film, I'm gonna sound like Mel Kiper, under the radar, but this is one of those, when Tony Danza is your big name, because he was doing Taxi at the time.
Yeah, he had just started doing Taxi.
Right, and I heard I listened to the DVD commentary, that's right, I did this for you people. but yeah, Tony was filming Taxi by day and then coming and shooting this at night. But yeah, so I guess we'll start with, first off, it's set in Beverly Hills, 1965, and Tubby's Drive-In, which apparently, according to the snobs, this is your typical slob versus snob story, the drive-in is being closed and they're going to, pave paradise and put up an office building. Sorry, Joni Mitchell. And it's the kids' last night of camaraderie at Tubby's on Halloween night, which we'll get to in a little bit, especially Southern California Halloween nights. And so anyway, I guess, Chris, do you remember the first time you experienced this film?
I do, and I think it was on HBO, believe it or not.
Of course.
Yep. I was probably over at a buddy's house, because I don't think I had HBO as a kid, but a friend of mine had it, and saw a bunch of those movies from the late 70s and early 80s as they, I don't know how much time Hollywood Nights spent in the theaters, but
not as long as it did on cable.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, I can remember just, thinking it was like you had explained, it was that slob versus snob, but it had a few big names and it had, great comedy, great timing, beautiful women. It had all the elements of that a teenage boy, was attracted to.
If you don't mind me asking, how old were you?
Let's see. I was probably, if it came out in 80, I may not have seen it till 82 or 80, may have been a couple years after. So I was probably, maybe 13 or 14.
Okay. I was probably 11 or 12. I didn't see it in the theaters. That was ladies and gentlemen, especially you young folks out there, there was that period of once a movie hit the theaters and then it was gone. Mm-hmm. And so then that's why the concept of home video and then cable became such a revelation of, oh, crud, we missed it in the theaters, but now you have a second and a third chance. Because if I remember right, I believe it was film, then video, then cable. I think that's how the old system used to work. So,
But it took a while.
It did take a while. You had to wait like 6 months for a video to come out. Yeah, so and then there was that period where you knew a film was bad when it was able to come out on video in like 2 months.
Or one month. You don't even remember it in the theater.
Right, quick turnaround. So, yeah. Mike, how about you?
I was of drinking age when the movie came out.
Lucky.
I remember fondly, just like Chris, watched it on HBO endlessly with my friends. It was like if Porky's and American Graffiti had a baby, it would be the Hollywood Nights.
Yeah, there is that look to it. I was, like I said, I was about 11 or 12. And, yeah, listening to the director commentary by writer-director Floyd Mutrix, he referred to it as Animal House for the car kids. Mm-hmm. I of course, kept thinking of it as an R-rated American Graffiti. Because it does have similar images, themes, characters.
True, yeah. The drag racing and all that kind of things, the cars.
Yeah.
But it was a little bit not quite as family friendly, you know.
Oh, heavens no. Oh, no. So but watching it again, I watched it twice in one day. I can't remember the last time I did that. Mm. But going through the slob versus snob thing, I was funny. I've maybe it's a different generational thing, but I remember showing my daughter, who's now 14. I remember showing her the film version of MASH, and her saying how mean spirited it was. If you think about the treatment of Hotlip and Frank, now for me, of course, it was these guys thumbing their nose at any form of authority. It just so happens with these two individuals. So anyway, I found that interesting. But I was going through thinking about how the pranks are pulled in this. And it does have an innocent feel to it. I mean, it's supposed to be Halloween of 1965. And there's little hints of things to come. Like the character of Jimmy, one of the Hollywood Knights who's got to go to Vietnam. And, sure. and the guys are treating it like it's World War II or Korea. The fact that there aren't that many pledges into the Knights. There's little hints of music by the Birds and the Mamas and the Papas.
Yep, 8-track tape.
So
yep.
there's that kind of, and of course, I think Floyd says in the commentary that really the 60s began in 1965, which explains if you think about the music in this, there's a lot of 50s tunes.
Great
in
music,
this.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and good luck getting this soundtrack. I mean, I think this is why it took so long for it to come out on video. It had the WKRP Miami Vice disease when it comes to song rights. Mm. Anyway, so, yeah, we have and the other thing is we have, let's see, one, we have the Hollywood Knights, we have Tony and Michelle,
yeah.
and we have Jimmy. So there's like three and the pledges. So,
and the pledges.
I mean,
so you got like four different
subplots
going on.
There's several plots going on. Yeah,
right.
There's a lot of stuff going on.
It's like an Altman film without the overlapping. So, yeah, on this night we have a kid who's about ready to go overseas, to go to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. We have a couple that are in, you know, late teen angst, even though they're in their 20s. All right, Danza was like 26. Michelle was not, thank God. Tony Danza and a young Michelle Pfeiffer. Mm-hmm. Salute.
Yeah.
Then we have the pledges. We have four guys that are trying to get into the car, the car gang. Club. So, Mike, tell them how they get into the initiation is.
The initiation was pretty simple. They took the pledges and took away their clothes, gave them spare tires, and told them they had to go to a record store in Watts in 1965.
With a white DJ.
With a white DJ. And get him to play a request song that then the Knights had to hear while it's still at Tubby's. They had to do it before 2 a.m.
Correct. So, yeah, naked with tires.
Yeah,
with
tires. Four tires, and that's it. No clothes. And, dropped off. Four white guys in the middle of Watts.
Or as Newbaum Turk says, you're lucky. Last year we put the pledges in a really bad neighborhood. but there is that thing of, and I think Floyd says in the coverage, he's like, doing it in 65 would be a little different than, say, 67,
yes.
68. Mm-hmm. That would. So it just kind of, you know, it's a slob comedy, folks. It's an R-rated grown-up. You know, some of us were too young to see it probably when it came out. Whatever. we're fine. But it does kind of ride that rail of really crossing, for me, crossing the line.
Yeah.
But then again, I think we had probably thicker skin back in 1980, I think.
Yeah.
It's one of those movies that, you know, if you're new to it and you grew up in, say, you know, after the turn of the century, you're going to find a lot of stuff in this movie offensive.
Yeah.
But those of us of a certain age and a certain tolerance for such things, you know, it's still to this day one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, I think Mrs. Soucy likes to use the term made by boys for boys.
Yes,
that's right.
And if you see what the Knights do, especially when Newbaum's taking photographs poolside and hanging out of trees.
These guys, let's face it, these guys weren't your just typical. I mean, they were pretty creative, clever pranksters. I mean, these weren't just these weren't just ham and eggers. You know?
Did you learn a lot of pranks from this? Because there's a couple things I discovered. Again, we're going to word this carefully. I did not know about the one-armed violinist until this film. This film also introduced me to the concept of filling a bag with something and setting it on fire.
Spiking the punch.
Well, I knew spiking the punch was liquor. Didn't know it was
not
that.
Liquor.
Yeah, thank you. Not liquor. So I hope you're rushing to Amazon now.
So
those pranks, and of course recording the twins as they're talking in the bathroom, little things like that. There is a moment in the film involving Neubaum Turk, played by Robert Wool, in his film debut, and at the time was a writer for Rodney Dangerfield, which explains a lot.
Oh, yeah, it does.
Because he tried getting a lot of his jokes in the film, and only a handful did. I can tell the punchline of one, his pants fit like a glove.
Yes.
So apparently, you know, he tried out as many jokes as he could, but there is a moment at a pep rally. Okay. So I mentioned this is Halloween night, 1965. There is a pep rally and a dance slash talent show.
At the high school.
At the high school. Yes. Who holds a pep rally at night?
Right.
Did you ever have one at night?
With a live band and
cheerleaders that forget certain clothing items.
True. Yes. Yeah.
And anyway, but I thought, really? I thought that was something you did in the daytime.
During school.
During school.
Yeah.
Am I right?
You're right.
Did you?
Oh, here, yeah.
Okay.
Here in Indiana, yes.
But
you're right.
That wouldn't have fit the script, though. Then they couldn't
I know that, but I thought that was slightly weird of doing it at night. And then the same night you have a talent show and or a dance?
Well,
yes. That's a lot of activity.
I always thought that this movie was kind of built like a Quentin Tarantino movie, where it kind of jumps forward and backwards and from scene to scene. It's nothing but a series of little, you know, segues.
Right.
Little sketches and then you move on to the next scene. You got more pranks, but like there's that one scene you mentioned with him recording in the bathroom. Well, he was just up a tree.
It's funny you mentioned that because as I was really studying this, and by the way, really studying it, there is a secondary or thirdary character, the blonde kid who's the skateboard sidewalk surfer, as he is called.
Yes.
Kind of tomboy, you know, not tomboy, but you know, kind of long haired, but smokes and skateboards. But he's at Tubby's in one scene, and then he's in the pep rally for the very next scene when a cheerleader forgets an item of clothing.
Right.
But, okay, so what Neubaum does in the pep rally, I will just say he performs along to the song Volare.
Yes.
And I was 11 when I saw this, and it was fall off the chair funny.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I fell out of my chair laughing so hard. And I specifically remember that. There's only a couple of moments in my younger days where I fell out of a chair or a couch laughing, and that was one of them.
Yeah. And that was like, Neubaum Turk is my hero. You know? who have you ever known that would pull something like that?
Did you do that for a while when you knew something was rumbling and you just sang to yourself, Volare.
Okay, now each of us here has daughters, but we don't have sons, right?
Yes.
No, I do.
I have two daughters.
I have one daughter. You know what it is? It's poetic justice for our youth.
Yeah. It's a punishment for being bad boys.
Yep.
Would you have wanted to name a son Neubaum?
Heck no. No. No, but I wouldn't want to name her Susie Q or Fran either.
Yeah. Fran Drescher, that's right. I mean,
we'll get to her. We'll get to her in a sec. But yeah, and I didn't think, and that, I mean, the song was ruined. Well, not really ruined. It was, I think, immortalized. And that is also a rare song because it has been immortalized twice. The second time, which actually my daughter did see, when Kevin Kline sings it in A Fish Called Wanda, when he's going through his myriad of Italian vocabulary to impress Jamie Lee Curtis. Thanks, Kev.
Yes.
Enjoy the Oscar. But yeah, that was a moment. I think that's funnier than... Oh, how should I put it? The yanking scene in Porky's. I know that's their kind of signature moment.
Right. Yeah. Although not the funniest scene in Porky's. We can talk about that.
Right,
later.
Correct. I think most of the stuff in in Animal House. Animal House is a great film, I think. But I think for me, Volare was the 550-foot home run out of the ballpark.
Yeah.
It just caught me at the right time. So, yeah, we've mentioned earlier. So we mentioned, you know, we have some cast, new cast members. So, yeah, Tony Danza was the big name. Young Michelle Pfeiffer, who had just done a TV series of Animal House called Delta House. Robert Wool in his debut. And Fran Drescher, who, as Floyd said, I guess was Miss New York in when she was 18, came to Hollywood, starred in the film he did before this. Do you remember American Hot Wax?
Yes.
Yes.
That's, yeah, which explains a lot with Floyd. The story of Alan Freed with Tim McIntyre. I think also Jay Leno's film debut in that. And she is in that with a squeeze scene, which we can't really talk about. Then she had a one-scene wonder where she grabbed John Travolta's tush in Saturday Night Fever, and then she got this film. Not a bad way to start out.
No,
building up to Bobby Fleckman and then The Nanny. So, yeah. yeah, we could do a myriad of Fran Drescher. We're not. So, but you kind of get.
But when we talk about UHF, we'll get around to her.
Right. So, but yeah, so you have these four different stories, and Mutrick said he probably thought he maybe had too many characters, and as I was watching it, the other knights. I mean, you have Jimmy, and then you have Tony Danza's character, I believe, is Duke, which
Mr.
had
Wheatley.
Yeah, you had the emotional scenes of those the older guys.
Yeah, the older guys didn't take part in any of the hijinks of the movie.
No, and I forgot there is one line exchange between Robert Wool and Tony Danza on the streets, and that's it. So yeah, that's a weird. But like the secondary guys that are in the car, the one who's trying to imitate James Dean,
right?
You know, really underdeveloped.
Yeah, it looks like all of Danza's scenes were shot in a day.
Probably were, but I mean,
for getting star billing, he's in like four scenes in the movie.
And that's never stopped a film before either. And the fact that they, I guess, Tubby's and the garage were literally next to each other. Yeah. So when one was up, the other was lit, the other one was, you know, lights were off, and they were able to bang through that.
I liked during the scene of where they gave the car to Jimmy Shine at the end, they even, you know, he kind of broke character and called Tony Danza by his real name. Remember, he said, Yellow, that's Tony Danza yellow. I mean, it was you had to figure that wasn't in the script.
It's not just, you know what? Breaking character is not just for Mark Hamill anymore.
Yeah.
So, and also the fact that, you know, there were emotional moments in a slob film long before Judd Apatow. Mm-hmm. I mean, I kept thinking back of, well, like Peter Riegert and Karen Allen in Animal House. That's probably your emotional core.
Yeah. There's your love.
That's your love story, yeah. And they really played it. They really played it well. And I think Tony and Michelle are fine in the, you know, the quick scenes that they have together.
Sure, yeah. But it did seem secondary to the hijinks and the pranks.
Yeah, we wanted more pranks and
more pranks,
or at least give us more Michelle Pfeiffer on roller skates.
That's
true. I'm sorry. Was that me? Yeah. thanks for that. Okay, so there's also, so I think we've talked about so we have the slob characters, we have the lovers, we have the kids that are doing the initiation.
How about the victims?
Well, we'll get to that. Okay. We have the victims who are flawed, for one thing. It would be, you know, compared to, say, Dean Wormer, who really didn't have any, if they caught Dean Wormer with his pants down, but that happens with Mrs. Friedman and her lover, which apparently
the whole movie developing into this, which
I think as a kid even added to it even more. Here's these stuffy authority figures who are pointing the finger at everybody, but they're also having an affair.
Yes.
That really helped.
Lee French in a great role. Those of you who are of a certain age will remember her from the Smothers Brothers comedy hour.
Yes.
Where she usually played a hippie. So this is really, a 180 for her.
Right.
Mrs. Friedman?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
because
I believe, how's
she
it going?
She played that part
hi.
Perfect.
Yeah.
I mean, she knocked that part out of the park, I thought. I mean,
it was the kind of North Side suburb housewife we would expect.
Right. Uptight, you know.
Right. And then, of course, you know, there's also a grab at the beginning of the film. I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
Then we have, and I know Mr. Perry has a little connection to this, the police.
Yes.
So Bimbo and Clark.
Officer
By the
Bimbo,
way,
yes.
It is not spelled B-I-M-B-O. I looked it up. It's a Cajun spelling.
Yes.
E-A-U-X.
Now, how do you pronounce his real name, the actor?
Well, Gaylord Sartain.
Thank you.
Gaylord Sartain.
I was trying to read it, and I don't even know how to pronounce
Gaylord
it.
Gaylord Sartain, of course, best known as that one of those guys from Hee Haw.
Right.
And but Mr. Perry has a story. Story time,
I
folks.
Do. Gaylord Sartain was starred in a movie that I have a I was an extra in called
nice.
Ernest Goes to Jail.
I've heard of it.
It's when I was living down in Tennessee. I was working at a TV station there, and they came and asked if we'd be interested in playing a news crew for this one scene that was actually shot at my bank.
Nice.
So, yeah, it was an all-nighter on the scene, and I played a photographer for a news crew. And I'm in all of 10 frames of this movie.
I was going to say, how long did it
My 10 frames of fame. But,
see, that's something less like me in Die Hard 2. Thank God for the pause button. You're like, tink, tink, tink.
There I am, see?
Yep.
That's me.
But if you look real close, you can see me with my camera on my shoulder looking up as Ernest supposedly gets blown through the roof of the bank.
And you're,
that
and
one,
you're
that one
shot of it.
Yeah. Yep.
That one film where Ernest gets blown up.
Yep.
Now, were you able to approach him?
Yes. Yes. We actually spoke briefly in the food service line.
And you told him your butt was grass and he was a lawnmower.
Nice. If I smell any rubber, no, Benedict Canyon.
No, I did mention to him that I remembered him from Hollywood Nights.
Did he appreciate?
Because everyone remembers him from Hee Haw. So
everybody
says
that.
He smiled. I at least got a smile out
yes.
of it.
Yes.
Now I don't know. There was so much talent. You know, I was going to say he had his own. Did he steal the show? New Bomb Turk was incredible. You know, you had all these angles coming at you. Like these guys, this is a action-packed, funny movie.
In the commentary, Floyd talks about that they would film like 10-minute takes of Bimbo and Clark in the car. They would just go. He apparently gave Gaylord like very little direction, if anything. As he said, he knew where the jokes were. So there's a scene where Bimbo is stuck in the bathroom while the knights have flooded the toilet, stuffed it down full of toilet paper.
Locked him in there, yeah.
Folks, don't do this at home. And you know what? Don't do this in public either. Just don't do it. So anyway, they stuff it down, and there's the moment where Bimbo has to, you know, use the facilities. Oh, by the way, the tearing of the magazine and ruffling it up, his idea.
Nice.
So you just let the camera roll. He'll come up with something. So... And then, of course, the door is locked, and there's trash spewed in the front. And then, things start to – but that was all him. It was just like kind of put the camera there. He'll make it funny.
He's brilliant. Yeah,
yeah.
I remember he even, like, murmured to himself, like, Clark. You know, he's, like, thinking about, like, all the stuff his partner was saying that made him mad.
But the scenes in the car – now, you heard one where, yeah, they would go for 10 minutes. See, I not jokingly said, I wish Criterion would put out a 2-disc set of the Hollywood Nights with commentary and essays and all that. I'd love to see the extended scenes. I'd love to see Clark and Bimbo in the car for 10 minutes going off.
The chemistry was good. I mean, it was two perfect casts for those two parts.
Yep.
And how would you like to hear the commentary today? Get Tony Danza in there. Get Robert Wool in there and Fran Drescher.
There's got
to
be a film festival in L.A. that just wants to have another screening of this. Please, somebody do this and then invite us.
Please.
Because most of them are still around, too.
Oh, yeah.
Why not? But yeah, and of course we played with Mike's cut earlier of the arguments over Lawrence of Arabia, which is now forever burned in my head.
Does it actually have lyrics or not?
And then the argument over Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, plus Gaylord says something. Well, we're wording this carefully. As children and young adults, we have certain words that we use when we call shenanigans on somebody, usually starting with a bull.
Right.
Thanks to him, we added horse.
Right.
we added horse.
Perfect. Yeah.
Yeah, because, well, boy, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah. Thanks. Thanks, Hollywood
Knights.
Sounds
good the way it rolls off your tongue like
that. It does. And there's a great scene where the PTA is having their meeting and the guys are yelling at each other in the kitchen finally, where there's just a pause in the conversation. You hear, horse. That was a beep, folks.
You open up a can of worms. We start talking about this film, and all the millions of funny little parts start coming back to you.
And most of them we can't really talk about.
No,
yeah,
we can't.
That's true.
But those who've seen it,
yes,
yeah,
You're welcome.
You'll get it.
You know exactly what it is. I was going back. I'm going through my notes. Yes, right here, folks. Notes like Jim Rome. That was the other. So there's we have a talent contest, and there's guys in their 30s playing 50s rock and roll, and the kids are really this was before there wasn't really a representation of the generation gap that was really going to hit with the mid 60s. But I think it was a guy who from Jay and the Americans was a part of that band and put that together. There's also we mentioned earlier the one-armed violinist.
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing I just discovered this last month, and so I thank my DVR for this, but I'm going to say, Chris, if I made an intro for you, it would probably be the censored words of Mr. Katzenberg.
Yeah.
But there's another staple in the slob comedies is the old person. There's usually like one old person that's either on the receiving end or witnesses something, and there is an old European gentleman who points out things.
Points out the obvious.
Loudly. Yes, loudly. and of course, that's the
nothing gets by him the whole
No, movie. Not quite. Not at all. Not the punch, not the violinist, nothing. But what's funny is with these films, we talked about there's like two dozen characters in this film, but they're burned into our memory because the film is that memorable. And if you saw them in anything else after this, you're like, hey, it's so-and-so. I remember this happened with Animal House and Caddyshack and Porky's. You're like, oh, hey, it's so-and-so. So I couldn't think of seeing this guy in anything else until he was the subplot in one of the most famous episodes of Barney Miller. Care to think which one of the most famous episodes of Barney Miller?
No.
Don't know.
The one involving the hash brownies.
Oh. Yeah.
The guys, of course, that an episode where I believe it's Wojo's girlfriend, he, of course, dates women from the other side of the tracks, brings a plate of brownies and doesn't tell him that it's filled with hash, and everybody in the precinct, including Fish, digs in. So
only in the 70s.
Right. But the secondary plot is there are two gentlemen, older gentlemen, who are arrested. One was a theater actor that's played by this guy, and then a theater critic. They're both Polish, and they got into a fight in the streets over a bad review. And I'm like, hey, it's the guy who yells
from Hollywood Nights.
Yeah, who yells those things we can't say. So little things like that. So thank you, IMDb and DVR, for that. Gosh, I'm going through all this.
Oh yeah, I'm going through the cast list now, so you can find his name.
I think I have it written down over here. Yes, I'm going through my things as well. I'll talk about that a little bit. We have Walter Janowitz, as Martin Katzenberg, who was in Barney. Now, for you TV buffs, that's you, Mike. I forget, he was Oscar Schmittner in Hogan's Heroes.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was also he also played an Amish guy in The Frisco Kid and played a rabbi in the Neil Diamond version of The Jazz Singer.
Wow.
Among others. I know. This is your – okay. One other thing I know we haven't gotten to just yet, and we were talking about the tone and the spirit and the pranks. One thing that really kind of resonated – and it took me a long time to figure this out is, of course, the Knights' pranks toward authority are very – direct and to the point. But there's also a character, and this is another stock character in the slob comedies, the nerd slash outcast, the honor student Dudley, played by Stuart Pankin.
That's right.
Who, by the way, was 33 years old when he did this film.
Playing a high school student.
He is right up there. He now ties with Stalker Channing in Grease.
I thought you were going to say Ralph Macchio in Karate Kid.
No. I thought Stalker. I had to correct myself on these very airwaves. I thought she was 36 when she played Rizzo. No, my bad. Only 33.
33.
But yeah. Oh, by the way, Tony Danza was 26. Robert Wool was 26. Gaylord was 30,
right,
but that's okay. Fran was 20. Michelle was 22. And Gary Graham, who played Jimmy, was 22. Yeah. 27, I'm sorry, 27. So, but
about 10 years older than their part was supposed to be.
Yeah, basically. Stuart Pankin, classically trained actor, had already done the San Pedro Beach Bums TV series before this. And
one season?
one season.
I remember that when it came on as a kid, and I don't think it made it to the end of the season.
It didn't.
No, it did not. And then I later saw him. I was like, hey, it's Dudley when he did Not Necessarily the News on HBO. Mm-hmm. But the treatment of Dudley. So Dudley has this overbearing mother, and he's just a kind of a dumpy guy and trying to get his awards.
Very sheltered.
He is abducted not once, but twice by the Knights for Newbaum's nefarious plans. But they treat him gentle.
Yeah.
And then
it's not mean-spirited at all.
No, and the first one, you're not quite sure. The second one, of course, he got to see ladies' body parts. Mm-hmm. And as they were blindfolding him, they gave him a beer.
They did, yes.
So between that and then there's a really nice part, the second half, near the end of the film, where he helps delay the police from chasing after some of the guys. And then he becomes part of the gang.
Yeah, and eventually gets a jacket at the very end.
That's right. He's holding Jimmy. I had never seen that before in a film, if I remember right, where an outsider, somebody that far outside the realm, is brought in. Can you guys think of another? I mean, I can't really.
You could argue, Flounder and Animal House. But
to a certain degree. But
Animal House was all,
he's kind of pledging that. Or I guess, it's not even that, but I immediately think of Mackenzie Phillips in American Graffiti. Mm-hmm. But that's different, and that's more emotional, not really romantic, although she wants it to be. That really resonated with me, and it took me a long time to figure out why.
You'd think with all the action going on in this film and all the different scenes and different people and that there'd be even room for one more guy like that.
Right.
It's like, I could just remember thinking these guys did so much stuff in one night. It was like, it was like a weekend's worth of pranks in about 6 hours.
I know. You felt bad. You're like, God, I'm really behind. We of course never TP'd anybody I think also the potato and the tailpipe. There was long before, 4 years before the banana and the tailpipe in Beverly Hills Cop.
Right.
Again, folks, please don't do this. Yeah. It's just what we read.
Well, I'm going through the cast list now, and even now there are faces popping up that were they in that movie? Really?
I'll tell you one that's funny is one of the guys who was in The Initiation, I saw as a comic later on HBO, Mike Bender. And Mike Bender did, he's done a little bit of acting, but he's now directing.
And writing. He did The Contender. He did.
Wait, are you sure? I thought that was Rod Lurie because I know he directed The Upside of Anger.
Right.
With Joan Allen and Kevin Costner. Black or White with Kevin Costner and Octavia Spencer.
Did he have a part in The Contender?
He might have had a part in The Contender. We'll have to check on that. Yeah. And then he also directed, that's going to bother me. Rain Over Me.
Yeah.
With Adam Sandler and Don Cheadle. So
Joyce Heiser. Remember Joyce Heiser?
Uh-huh.
She was one of the Weintraub sisters.
Yes. And the other one was the daughter of Eli Wallach and Ann Jackson.
Wow.
Wow, man. That's
cool. And Cindy Williams' sister is one of the blondes. There's also, again, we talk about underwritten characters, but they have an impression. There's a blonde, right out of central casting, tall, blonde, skinny surfer guy named Tarzan with two blonde beauties on each arm.
Jane and Cheetah.
Thank you.
Jane and Cheetah.
Again, don't name your kids that. But there is, and there's also that moment of car culture versus surf culture. It's only a couple minutes. And then they go away. But, they do tap into – because, in the 50s, especially – American Graffiti is set in 1962. Mm-hmm. And that – and, of course, it's away from the beach, if I remember right. I think it's Central California. But, car culture and surf culture were different. And they dug each other, but I think they were kind of rooted one way or another, almost like Beatles and Stones.
Yes, he was in The Contender. Mike Binder.
Okay,
was in,
all right. So you were good there.
Yeah.
Also found out the cinematographer was a guy named William Fraker, who, 5 nominations for cinematography.
Nice.
Before working on The Hollywood Knights, in 1 year, did the cinematography for Rosemary's Baby and Bullet, Exorcist II, The Heretic, Sharky's Machine. Loved Burt Reynolds in that film. Later did Honeymoon in Vegas, but he got nominated for doing cinematography for Looking for Mr. Goodbar, Heaven Can Wait, 1941, and War Games. So not bad for just a little $3 million picture. Yeah. And yeah, there's little things. You were saying earlier, Chris. There's of course you have to have the drag racing scenes, which do nothing to move the movie along. Just I think the fact that they had the two Chinese guys and one of them was a famous car painter, and the fact that they didn't get permits, of course.
Right. Of course.
Directors, don't do that. But there's two drag races. One, and I think they're both set to What I Say by Ray Charles, but one that the Chinese guys win, and of course, in the second one, USA wins. So
that's right. Yeah. That's right. And everybody cheers. That's right.
Fraker also did Close Encounters and Cuckoo's Nest.
Wow.
That's not bad.
Two blockbusters, huh?
Exactly. So, yeah. So, anyway, it's just fascinating with all of this going on. There's so many scenes and moments, and even like I said, even if they're underwritten, I think of that. There's two knights that are in the car, and they're worried about the future of the gang and what they're going to do. And there was already a couple of gang films of different styles before this. You had the Warriors, of course, Walter Hill's film that looked like futuristic. It felt like futuristic New York, even though it was late 70s New York. And The Wanderers.
Yes.
And The Wanderers, you've seen that?
I've seen that many times.
You haven't seen The Wanderers?
The Wanderers.
Really?
It's Bronx.
Ooh.
Gangs of the... Of
Ken
the,
Wall.
Yep.
Karen Allen. The guy who played
the
Meat
guy who played
in
Perry.
Porky's.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Oh, you got to find that. I should let you borrow.
I saw The Wanderers also on HBO.
Oh, yeah. That thing was on constantly.
Yeah.
And that was another film that mixed the end of the 50s with the beginning of the 60s, because you had the scenes with the Baldies and the Ducky Boys, which were terrifying.
Yes.
And so you have this gang that's, again, they look like they're in their mid-20s playing high schoolers. I guess that's a thing. You know, if you're in your mid-30s, you can be in college. Look at Tim Matheson and Up the Creek.
Yeah.
But there is moments of when their world, you know, the outside world is starting to peek in. Like Karen Allen's character, of course, is becoming sort of an independent female. She reads D.H. Lawrence of Arabia. Different Lawrence. But there's also a scene at the end where Ken Wall's character follows her, and she goes into a coffee shop, and there's some skinny guy with big hair and a guitar.
Robert Zimmerman?
Right, singing The Times They Are A-Changin'.
Yes.
And then there's two gang members that, well, one comes from an abusive household, and they leave, and they're going to San Francisco. And it was funny because you're watching this, and you're like, yeah, it could be an easy punchline of, oh, two guys are moving into Frisco together.
Right.
But you're not sure, and you're not 100%. Maybe, maybe not. But it didn't matter because it's two really nice performances and a pretty decent storyline with those guys.
Oh, yeah.
And there are moments of that. We said before in this film with the references to Vietnam, with the music by the Byrds and music by the Mamas and the Papas. Really, really impressed with just bringing it up.
Yeah.
So,
Heck yeah.
You know what? Let's take a short break and then we'll gather our notes and we'll continue talking about the Hollywood Nights because we can. You're listening to a very special film sociology here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. Welcome back to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msoci@WFYI.org. Also on Facebook, also on Twitter at Matthew Soci. Hanging out with Mike Perry and Chris Elberfeld, talking about the Hollywood Nights because we can. we can make a whole show devoted to this.
And yes, no one else will.
That's right. So if not us, then who?
Who will? I mean, honestly, that I remember the first time we started talking about it, it was like, hey, here's somebody who knows this movie. You don't run into people every day that know this movie.
And by the way, hard to quote that movie at work, at least our work.
That's right. Yeah, you have to be very clever.
If you worked at Smitty's Garage, maybe, and maybe Tubby's, but we don't. We're here. Yeah, we learn to be clever and know when not to say stuff.
We would do like half of it. So we would
right.
So
you'd
suggest, you know, what it is, but not finish
it. It's like when I would do Abdul with radio with Abdul, and we start quoting Python or Richard Pryor until we can't.
Right, yeah. There is a line.
There is a line there. So, okay, there was something we talked about in the first two-thirds of the show. We're in the last third. There's sort of a correction, and now I have to go watch it again to see what is actually said. Mike, you have an update. Yeah, breaking news on a 35-year-old film line
right.
update.
Okay, we were talking about the scene where they're giving Jimmy the beautiful yellow car, mm-hmm. Hot Rod. And I'll read from IMDb the trivia section for Hollywood Nights. It says, when the crew is gathered in Smitty's speed stop around the Ford, Duke, Tony Danza, asks, is this?
Blank yellow.
Yellow.
Urine yellow?
There you go. That's good. We can say that on NPR.
Now, everyone thinks the answer that comes back is, it's Tony Danza yellow. But it's not really.
Okay.
It's Tony Nancy yellow. Because Tony Nancy, a Southern California car customizer, and drag racer, known for his yellow cars, was involved with the making of the film.
Right.
So, but if you go back to quotes, the quotes in IMDb still say Tony Danza yellow.
So it could be.
It could be.
Or Hold Me Closer, Tony Danza.
Yeah.
But yes, we're going to get the movie back out. we're going to settle this once and for all.
You know what, Criterion, there's 5 minutes on your disc for this line alone, I think.
Yeah. I mean, we were talking earlier about how many times we've seen it. And, you know, I've probably seen this movie over 50 times, maybe
easily.
75.
And this includes HBO.
And I've still to this day, until Mike just said that, thought it was Tony Danza.
See, this is the beauty of a piece of art. It changes. You change over time, even though the film does not.
Yes.
See that? Take that, George Lucas.
Yeah.
Don't mess with it.
Put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Or the tailpipe.
I think the bigger explosions are kind of cool.
And new bomb shot first.
Yes.
There is a scene with him and Fran. Another scene with they apparently. Moving on, but apparently that also went on for 10 minutes because you had Robert Wool and Fran Drescher, two vocal titans that could knock people over verbally. And they kind of there is a scene where they're kind of overlapping, and he finally exclaims he's glad he did what he did.
Right.
So there.
He achieved nirvana. How about that?
Right. Let's move on fast. Yeah. Yeah, I probably see it just as many times because of cable. Now, it's one thing if we rented it 50. You might as well just buy the damn thing when it's all said and done.
I think one of my friends had recorded it off of HBO.
So they
had the blank cassette. You know,
VHS
cassette that we probably watched till it wore out.
So there are certain – and, of course, there are certain scenes where the tape is a little more worn than
absolutely.
Others.
Yes.
Pause.
Yeah.
Like the scene we were just talking
about. In 1981, I'm like, I wish I had $500 for a video printer. This would rule. Again, don't do this at home.
No.
You kids have it so easy these days.
But we do it here, so you don't have to.
Like we were saying, though, this is a film that, you know, was overlooked by a lot of people. I mean, there's how many people our age probably don't even know what it is.
Right. And so, anyway, looking back at the film career of Floyd Mutrix, who I know he's done a little bit of musical theater production, and there's some lawsuits with that, but we won't talk about that. But, like, in 1971 was his film debut, which he wrote and directed, called Dusty and Sweets McGee, which is on the Warner Archives. I believe it's two lovers who grow into drug addiction. 1975, and I only got this because I knew he was involved with it, but there was a film called Aloha, Bobby, and Rose with Paul LaMatte and Diane Hull.
Yeah.
And this was so, of course, Paul LaMatt was in American Graffiti. And because of the success of American Graffiti, almost everybody in that film got a starring vehicle. And this was his. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of, Tim McIntyre, who we'll get to in a little bit, it was kind of a modern day Bonnie and Clyde. If Bonnie and Clyde were on the Sunset Strip in 1974. With also great music, don't know where they got the rights to it. I always remember a great shot of the Sunset Strip with Junior Walker and the All-Stars playing in that. Tim McIntyre is in this film. He would play Alan Freed in his film American Hot Wax, which I remember seeing in the theaters with my parents. That came out in 78. And, of course, Freed, the famous rock and roll DJ. And at that time, they were able to get Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee Lewis, and was it Little Richard, I believe?
Who
play themselves at the first rock and roll concert. Then, of course, the Hollywood Nights in 1980, and then a film with Rick Schroeder. Yeah, he was Rick then. In 1994, called "There Goes My Baby." He would also have story or screenplay credits for "Freebie and the Bean," James Caan and Alan Arkin, "American Me," the film starring and directed by Edward James Olmos. Blood In, Blood Out, which was the Taylor Hackford film. I believe Benjamin Bratt was in that. 3-hour film about living in the Chicano section of Los Angeles. And then he had a story credit for Mulholland Falls, the Hat Squad film with Nick Nolte back in 1996. So
another really underrated film.
Really?
If you enjoy, you know,
Guys wearing hats and kicking butt and taking names. So anyway, fascinating. And Floyd Muttrix is still around. He has a website. You can go check it out. Yeah, you can tell him, we're talking about his work here at NPR.
It lives.
It does live. So we were talking earlier about where does the R-rated slob comedy begin? And some people would say Animal House, but I was going through, and I'm sure there's a myriad of smaller titles that I'm forgetting, so I can't wait for your emails. But I think the first one for me is 1974 and Blazing Saddles.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which you were telling a story earlier of showing it to young folks and didn't quite have the same reaction as we did.
Well, yeah. I mean, I was working with a bunch of 20-year-olds, and I was 30-some at the time, and we were talking about movies that really made us laugh. And to this day, Blazing Saddles can make me laugh out loud and blow, whatever I'm drinking right through my nose. But they'd never seen it. And so I invited them over to the house and showed it to them, and they were absolutely appalled, particularly at the number of times white men say the N-word.
Right.
And back in the 70s, it was even pushing the envelope back in the 70s.
Correct.
But, you know, when you have Richard Pryor as one of the writers, that's going to happen.
And also the fact that Pryor didn't do all the quote unquote black jokes.
Right.
You know, Mel Brooks wrote a lot of those.
But it ruined the entire movie for them.
Wow.
So, you know, they didn't even make it to the campfire scene before they were just totally disengaged.
Wow, we're old.
Yeah.
We're old and of different generation.
That's too bad. I mean, to me, that they don't get Mel Brooks. Then they need to maybe see some of his other films.
Young Frankenstein, silent movie.
Yeah. Right.
Boy, The Producers,
Spaceballs.
There you go. Okay, so also in 1974, The Longest Yard.
Nice.
Thank you, Bert. And The Groove Tube.
Oh yeah.
That of course there's a couple of those films that come later in the decade of their. Basically, before SNL, there was adult sketch comedy.
Kentucky Fried Movie?
Yes, that's one of
Tunnel
those.
Tunnel Vision
actually,
was another one.
Tunnel Vision, Can I Do It Till I Need Glasses, which had Robin Williams. Really cheap, quickly made film. But yeah, 1977, Kentucky Fried Movie. 1978, of course, you have Animal House, and that really blew it up. That also in 1978, Up in Smoke.
Nice. Yep.
People would probably say that the apex of the R-rated slob comedy could be 1980 because in 1 year, ladies and gentlemen, you have Caddyshack, The Hollywood Nights,
yep.
Airplane,
mm-hmm.
History of the World Part One, Used Cars, and Mad Magazine's Up the Academy.
What about the other Richard Pryor, Gene Wilder, they get locked
Stir
in.
Crazy?
Stir
no,
Crazy.
I don't think that's a slob comedy. I think because one of the things that, and I'm almost leery to put Airplane on this list and to a certain degree, blazing. Well, I think we're thinking of, I think, you know, the horny guys chasing after girls.
Right on.
It has
yeah.
to be a major or at least a minor part of that. Sorry, folks, that's what it is.
Slight degree of immaturity to it.
Slight, yep. yeah, slight degree of that. And those were all in 1 year.
Right.
1981, you had Stripes. And in 1982, in 1 year, Porky's. And then my friend Erin, she put in two guesses as we were – she had asked me what we were going to be talking about on social media. One of her guesses was used cars.
Right.
Love used cars.
Classic, yeah.
yep.
Thank you, Kurt Russell. But she also asked if we were going to talk about Night Shift.
I love Night Shift.
Not a
complete.
Maybe no teenagers, but although the Clint Howard character maybe, but
yes.
But yeah, these are all a part of our canon. Well, us three. I don't know about you guys, but
Night Shift was Billy Blazejowski. that was Michael Keaton's kind of first
right out
big,
the gate.
Right?
I mean, you know, Henry
his
Winkler.
His character was so funny. I remember.
Yeah, that was supposed to be the movie to make a movie star out of Henry Winkler,
and it did.
It
not really.
Kind of made a movie star out of Michael Keaton.
Yeah, it did, and salute to Shelley Long.
Yeah.
But yeah, because he had already had a couple of films after because he was in Heroes and
yes.
the one and only
Heroes.
The Lords
was
of Flatbush.
Sad, though, wasn't it?
Well, Lords of Flatbush was before Happy Days. That's 74.
Okay.
But these were at the during his reign on Happy Days. Mm-hmm. Where so he had three attempts at being a movie star during the series, and they even sadly Night Shift didn't do that well.
No.
Although again, it was on cable constantly.
Right, I love it. Yeah,
yeah, it's yeah. This and we can quote Michael Keaton quite a bit. Not on this show, of course.
I just love the plot in that movie. You know, let's take a funeral home, you know, graveyard shift, so to speak. You know, and open up a side business on top of it.
And it was also, you know, the young upstart who had just gotten out of the Roger Corman School of Filmmaking and got to do a major picture for Warner Brothers. Way to go, Ron.
Yeah.
So, all right.
Whatever became of him?
I think he did a Moby Dick film last year.
Oh, cool.
So, we got a few more minutes before we wrap up on this very special Film Sociology Hollywood Nights. And I'm already going to date the show already because we have a moment for dead people we like because we never have time for dead people we don't like. And I hope I'm saying this right. And I'm sorry if I say it wrong. Pardon my anyway. Actor Bert Kwok, Kwouk.
Mm-hmm.
Who was born in England, died on May 24th at the age of 85. Gentlemen, he did a lot of TV. He did quite a few movies. But if anything else, you will always remember him as Cato.
Oh, yeah.
The Pink Panther. Yeah.
Inspector Clouseau.
Right. So, you know, if there's time at the end, maybe, you know, I'm not the first one to say, of course, at his funeral, he will jump out of the casket and attack Clouseau.
With a stick and beat you down.
Again, he is. I should say this because we do this quite often. You've witnessed Mike on the show. The man had a full career. He had a full working career, and he's going to be best known for attacking Peter Sellers.
Yep.
Right.
And it's funny as hell.
Playing a part with very few lines.
No. You know? And the great moment of they're fighting, and no matter what happens, if the phone rings, he answers it.
Yes.
That's a good
he
service.
He stays loyal. Yes.
And yes, college students. Yes, Clouseau shouldn't have called him his little yellow friend.
Yeah.
I got it. But the fight scenes are funny as hell.
Yeah.
Yes.
So.
Especially the slow motion.
And you know what? That might have been, for a bunch of us, our introduction to the concept of the joke in slow motion.
Yes.
So I'm looking back to see what else he had done before, especially if you're a TV or a bit player, you know, what other things. That's not a reflection of your career, sir.
No.
Films like Passport to China, The Sinister Man from the 1960s, of course, Shot in the Dark. He played Mr. Ling in Goldfinger.
Mm-hmm.
Was in three different episodes in the early 60s of The Avengers. Of course, he was in The Brides of Fu Manchu with everyone's favorite Asian actor, Christopher Lee. was uncredited in Casino Royale. Was Spectre number 3 in You Only Live Twice. Played Chairman Peng in The Shoes of the Fisherman. Was in The Chairman, Deep End. Of course, all the Pink Panther films. Was the Doctor in Rollerball, the original Rollerball, the
James
only
Conn,
one
yes.
that matters. Yeah,
right.
That remake is terrible.
That was another one I saw on HBO.
Constantly.
Yes.
Great stuff. The last remake of Bogest, sorry. Played Lin Futu in 1982 in Doctor Who. films like Plenty. He played Mr. Chen in Empire of the Sun, was in Kiss of the Dragon, Carry On Columbus. And one of the last things he did was, I think in 2010, he was in several episodes of Last of the Summer Wine for you PBS people out there.
Oh, you Telly Club members.
There you go. So, Bert, thank you. You made us laugh. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
So, gentlemen, we just got a couple minutes. Closing thoughts on The Hollywood Nights, Chris.
Well, I'm probably going to go home and watch it again today.
So
once I start talking about it, I need to go back and feed my imagination.
Have you forced this film on your family yet?
They wouldn't get it. I mean, my wife and my two daughters would not. They would probably walk out of the room and say, well, "This is stupid," or something. You know, but.
And they'd be right, but
that's
still
that's why it's funny.
That's why it's funny. If you haven't seen the movie, see if you can, you know, rent a copy or stream it, or you know, check Amazon. You can get it at a very reasonable price.
Yes,
and just let it flow over you. Don't try to think too much about it. Just enjoy the little
sketch. We're still quoting it 35 years later.
You're making it sound like a Kubrick film. It's like 2001. But yeah, you're right.
But it does have Robert Wool. It does have Fran Drescher, Tony Danza, Michelle Pfeiffer, Stuart Pankin. I mean, there are some big names.
You know what? I still think it's – and I'm sure Robert Wool would tell me to go bleep myself, but I think it's his best work. And this is the man that created Arliss and was in Batman.
Yeah,
so.
I agree, though. That his character of Newbomb Turk was
It was supposed to be
not
the
your ordinary guy.
It was supposed to be the Bluto of the group, and, well, I guess it was. But
he had a very – it seemed like a very high IQ. This is a very smart guy, not just a prankster. But
except when he messes with his brothers, El Camino.
That's true. Oh, the pie wagon. Oh.
And yeah, so anyway, gentlemen, we have some words to live by.
Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, he's an English guy. He came to fight the Turkish.
Okay, Clark, right there. That's what I'm talking about. Lawrence of Arabia doesn't have any lyrics to it, doesn't have any words.
What do you mean doesn't have lyrics?
It's music.
To it?
It's music.
Hey, I've seen the movie four times.
And there were no words to it.
What are you
there are no words to that. Did you hear what I was singing earlier?
Somewhere I know that somebody, I think, wrote lyrics to this song.
Go see this great movie. You deserve it, whether you know it or not. Chris, Mike, thanks for hanging out.
Thank you, Matt. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Matt.
You've been listening to a very special film sociology, The More You Know. So go find this. I own a copy of it. You're on your own. I'm happy to own this. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
Inspector Clouseau's residence.
The phone is ringing.
There you go, from 2016, from September of 2016, including Mrs. Sosie intro, Chris Alberfeld and Mike Perry, happy birthday, Mike, and our breakdown of The Hollywood Nights. Yes, friends, your pledge dollars at work. All right, words to live by, go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. Hopefully we'll do a show next week, and then probably no show, no film sociology the last week of December, and then the first Friday in January, my top 10 of 2022. So I hope you have a great holiday. We will try this again next week, hopefully. So thanks for listening. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. And here's a little bit of Angelo Badalamenti and the theme from Blue Velvet. Take care, everybody.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What kind of parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
Okay. We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!